My name is Nicola, and I want to hold your baby. Seriously, do you have a baby? I want to hold it. I love babies. It's a trait that I shared with my dad. Babies and campfires, he used to say, are the two things you can just stare at forever. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my dad. His name was Tom. He was reserved, gentle, patient, kind, and funny. His humor was dry and understated. He was a slim guy, and you wouldn't have pegged him for an athlete, but he was good at just about every sport. At his funeral, several people told me separately that he was the smartest person they ever knew. After high school, he was accepted to MIT. But instead, he followed his high school sweetheart to the University of Virginia, where he studied religion and philosophy. They married right after graduation, and I came along a few years later. He worked at a bank and then later a bookstore, but he would have made an excellent professor. He was a reader and a music lover. He used to sing me lullabies when I was small, not children's songs, but things that he liked, the Beatles, James Taylor, Simon and Garfunkel. After first reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings trilogy at age 10, he reread all four books every summer for the rest of his life. He loved Star Trek and MASH and Calvin and Hobbes. He always had time for a game of catch. A mathematician at heart, he kept the stats on a handwritten spreadsheet for his office fantasy football league for years. This was before Yahoo existed to do it for you. Never once was I able to beat him at cribbage. He knew at least something about pretty much everything, and I could always go to him for a clear, simple explanation about any historical event or political situation or math problem. He was my oracle. And he wasn't just my dad, he was also a brother to three siblings, a husband, a son to parents who thought he hung the moon. He died from metastatic lung cancer when he was 48 and I was 23. In a little over 2 years, I will be the same age that my father was when he died. And beginning next summer, and then for the rest of my life, I will have lived longer without him than I did with. I miss him so much. I am so sad that he never met his grandchildren. Today, I want to talk about grief. We began this month by remembering and honoring our ancestors and departed beloveds. And now, having just observed Thanksgiving, we have officially entered the holiday season. A time that can intensify feelings of loss and grief. It's an important topic, and one that we in the West tend to gloss over in public. But grief is something that I grapple with to varying degrees every day. Maybe you do too. I want to start by saying that I am not an expert in grief or in psychology or anything really, other than my own experience. There is so much good content already out there on this subject. I will not be reinventing the wheel. I'm speaking about grief today, not as a person who has figured it all out, but as a person who is always working on it. Grief is our response to loss, often death, but that's not the whole story. For example, we can experience grief at the end of a relationship. We can grieve a life-changing diagnosis. Our own or a loved one's, that our bodies or brains just don't work the way they used to. We can grieve when things just don't work out the way we thought they would. We feel collective grief for the state of our country and our planet. We can even grieve changes that are positive, like when our children grow up and leave home. I had about seven sermons worth of group notes on grief. There is just so much to talk about. But today I'm going to share one story from my life and hope that the specific can serve as the universal. Then we'll talk about some small things we can do to help us manage our grief day to day. One other note, at some point I am definitely going to cry. In the class that UU lay sermon writers take, we learn that it's best to preach from your scars, not your wounds. Grief is tricky though, because I don't know about you, but my scars reopen all the time. However, tears are okay. As actor Andrew Garfield shared in an interview after the loss of his mother, if I cry, it's only a beautiful thing. It's just all of the unexpressed love. At the end of April 2003, I received a birthday card from my dad, which was normal, but its content was not. In it, he had written a quote, a few lines from something that I didn't recognize, but the strange thing was that one of the words was misspelled. Instead of writing what I guessed was the word shine, S-H-I-N-E, he had written the word Stein, S-T-I-N-E. My dad didn't misspell words, and he certainly wouldn't have mailed a handwritten card with an uncorrected mistake. Something felt off. I didn't yet know about the other symptoms he was experiencing. Less than 2 weeks after I received that card, I had taken a leave of absence from my brand new job and was with him as he began radiation treatment for his multiple brain tumors. They told us he had 3 to 6 months. It was 3. He was gone by the end of July. I could talk for a long time about how wonderful my dad was and how much I adored him. And he was wonderful. But life is hard and people are complicated. And there are some things that I'd really rather not tell you. The quick version is that during my teenage years, he struggled with alcohol and depression. And after years of trying everything to help him, there was a painful but necessary divorce just before I turned 17. This was the first time I lost my father while he was still alive. I felt like he had abandoned us. He did abandon us. And he abandoned himself. Addiction is powerful and destructive. Over the next 6 years, I fought so hard to maintain our relationship. Like many children of alcoholics, my feelings of self-worth were tied deeply to his behavior. His inclination was to withdraw, but I kept trying. When he got sick, it felt like perhaps it could be a chance to heal some wounds. When we knew that he was dying, I wrote my dad a letter, telling him how much I loved him and would miss him, what I had learned from him, and that I would try to make him proud. And I wanted so badly for him to write me back. In my mind, this was his chance to make amends. I wanted words of wisdom from him, guidance, assurance. I wanted an apology for all of the harm that he didn't mean to inflict, but did nonetheless. Most of all, I wanted proof that I was worthy of love and that I had his. I wanted him to spell it out. Well, that's a lot. What a thing to expect from someone facing his own mortality to change his personality, become a mind reader, and suddenly hand out emotional closure. I have so much compassion for that young woman, still a girl really, who just wanted to hang on to her dad any way she could. He did write down a list of his favorite books and movies for me. And the time we spent together during those last weeks, much of it as a family again, was healing in its own way. But there was no grand farewell, no letter, just a quiet goodbye, which was his way. It's amazing how raw a loss can feel after so many years. How is that possible? The first thing to remember is that you're not doing it wrong. There is no timeline for grief. Our grief doesn't fade because our love doesn't fade. But grief doesn't feel like love most of the time, does it? It can feel like sadness, loneliness, helplessness, despair. It can feel like anger. And there are other feelings that can be a bit more prickly, maybe a bit more difficult to talk about. Things like guilt, numbness, shame, even relief. All of these feelings are valid, and all of them are grief. So let's get practical here for a minute. When someone is in the throes of fresh grief, they require specialized attention. Acute loss calls for acute care. And how to help someone in the wake of an immediate loss, or how to attend your own needs in that time, is a topic for a whole other sermon. But what I want to talk about today is what we do after, forever after. Grief is not something to be resolved. It's work that we never finish. Most of us carry our grief pretty quietly, moving through our lives as if everything is fine, because that's what we have to do, right? We keep moving forward while carrying the weight of losses that have changed everything. So, what are some things we can do to help support the work of grief in our everyday lives? Here are three categories of action that I have found helpful. The first is to accept. You may recognize this from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's famous five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. My definition is slightly different, however, because I'm not talking about acceptance of the death or other loss, but the acceptance of grief itself. There is no cure for grief, and we have to accept it as a permanent part of our lives. But more than that, welcome it into the mix, just like the lemon juice in the punch. Grief is not linear, it's wild. And our relationship with someone can continue to change even after they have died. Even though you have moved through one phase, you may not be done with it. You may feel that you've reached a certain level of peace or forgiveness or whatever it is, and then years later, you can find yourself wrestling with that same issue again. I thought I had worked through my anger, but it's been back full force this year. It will ebb and flow, and we have to make room for that. It's normal. Life moves in cycles and spirals, and grief is no different. Acceptance is not an achievement, it's a practice. Meditation teacher Corey Mascara reminds us that we are not required to heal all of our pain before we can enjoy our lives. We can live with our grief as part of the whole that also includes wonderful things. As Reverend Alice tells us time and again, joy and grief are both parts of the fabric of life, and they are woven fine. Salt, then sour, then sweet. Here's a good place to bring up gratitude, which is our transformational theme for the month of November. It's hard to think about gratitude as it relates to grief without veering into toxic positivity. I think it's okay to be grateful for the person or thing that you lost and still be really unhappy about losing them. It's okay to be grateful for hard lessons while still wishing you hadn't had to learn them. Stephen Colbert offered a powerful perspective in a beautiful interview with Anderson Cooper, during which he spoke of losing his father and two teenage brothers in a plane crash when he was just 10 years old. Colbert had said something to another interviewer previously about, quote, learning to love the thing that he most wishes had not happened. Cooper asked him to elaborate on this, and here's his response. It's a gift to exist, he said. And with existence comes suffering. There's no escaping that. But if you are grateful for your life, which I think is a positive thing to do, and I'm not always, then you have to be grateful for all of it. You can't pick and choose what you're grateful for. So what do you get from loss? You get awareness of other people's loss, which allows you to connect with that other person, which allows you to love more deeply and understand what it's like to be a human being. To connect with them and to love them in a deep way that not only accepts that all of us suffer, but then also makes you grateful for the fact that you have suffered, so that you can know that about other people. It's about the fullness of your humanity, he continued. What's the point of being here and human if you can't be the most human you can be? Not the best, but the most. I want to be the most human I can be. And that involves acknowledging and ultimately being grateful for the things that I most wish didn't happen, because they gave me a gift. I'll be mulling over that for a while. Let's call the second category engage. Even though we may feel it all the time, we sometimes need help actually tapping into our grief. The first piece of this is to connect with other people. Everyone you know has experienced some kind of loss, and they're probably more willing than you might think to talk about it. Meet up with someone for a grief walk or a grief coffee hour and share stories. It takes some bravery and may feel awkward at first, but give it a try. Call me. I'd love to hear about your person. Of course, there are grief groups you can join, but what if you prefer not to grieve in a group setting? There are so many other ways you can engage in solitude and on your own timeline. Another piece of this category is creativity. Take your broken heart and turn it into art. Write a poem or a journal entry, paint a picture, write a song, play a song. Bake some bread, make something. It doesn't have to be good. No one ever has to see it. It's just for you, a way to express and process. If you claim that you're not creative, do what I did. Create a playlist of your person's favorite songs or songs that remind you of them. If I notice that I'm really missing my dad, I will listen to it. It helps me to focus and connect with what I'm feeling. And then I can move forward when the songs have finished. Engage with art that other people have made. Read books, watch movies, listen to podcasts. There are infinite social media accounts that deal with grief. In particular, I'll mention the writers Suleika Jawad and Catherine May for their powerful memoirs about different kinds of loss. Anderson Cooper's podcast, All There Is, offers a deep and beautiful exploration of grief. He describes the experience of making the show and connecting with others on this topic as the most profound work of his life. I just read a review of the new movie Hamnet, which said, "I don't know if there has ever been a better depiction of grief and how it complicates relationships, love, and humanity, and the power of art as an alchemized force for healing, connection, and letting go." Wow. If you're like me, a person who feels deeply but isn't always able to articulate those feelings, it's supremely helpful to be exposed to the words that others use to describe grief. That moment of, "Yes, me too, that is exactly it," is both satisfying and validating, and can give you the language you may be missing. There are people here in our UUCL community who have written so beautifully about grief on Facebook. Eve German, Lisa Gascoon, Martha Mason, I'm talking about you. Sometimes reading or hearing about someone else's experience can be the gateway you need to process something that you may not have been able to access easily. Their words can be your guide. The third category is move, by which I mean moving our bodies. We are not just brains on sticks, but human animals whose bodies experience our lives along with our minds. Our bodies can harbor the effects of our struggles. The issues are in the tissues, as the saying goes. The body keeps the score. Meditation and somatic movement teacher Sarah DeSimone, who I quoted earlier in the service, says this: "You can talk about your pain for decades. You can name every diagnosis, recite every origin story, map every trigger. But until your body enters the room, until you let yourself feel the very thing your mind keeps narrating, nothing rewrites. The imprint remains. Thinking can name the wound, but only embodied experience can rewrite it. This is why spiritual practice, trauma healing, and nervous system repair aren't about more clever thoughts. They're about returning to the body as the original text." It turns out that science backs this up. Dr. Emily Nagoski, who wrote a book called Burnout, The Secret to Unlocking the Stress Cycle, talks about how we need to deal physically with our mental issues. When our ancestors faced a stressor, it was often in the form of an animal chasing them, and in response, they ran. If they survived, that physical exertion helped to complete the stress cycle, reducing or resolving the physiological reaction and returning their bodies and brains to a state where they could think, feel, and respond effectively. In our modern lives, we are constantly being chased by metaphorical wild animals, but we're not running anymore. So for us, the stress cycle remains open. Dr. Nagoski's book highlights 7 different ways to complete the stress cycle, which include deep breathing, deep belly laughter, and crying. But by far the most effective, she said, is physical activity. Now, grief doesn't exactly make us feel energized, so this one takes some concerted effort. But the good news is you don't have to run unless you love it. You don't even have to have any kind of fancy exercise routine, although it's great if you do. Things like walking, gardening, jumping on a trampoline, or even an impromptu dance party in your kitchen can do the trick. If your mobility is limited, even something like shaking your arms and legs for a minute or two can be very effective. The trick is consistency. Remember how grief never goes away? We have to keep our bodies moving regularly to help us ride those waves. Accept, engage, move. 3 things we can work into our regular lives to help manage our grief, knowing that sometimes it will push its way out front and other times step back. We can make room for it all. Salt, then sour, then sweet. A friend of mine once posted something on Facebook that I think about all the time. There were 2 photographs side by side. The first of her great-great-grandmother holding a toddler, my friend's beloved great-grandmother, in her lap. The second photo was of my friend holding one of her own babies 110 years later. "Love abides," she wrote in the caption. Love abides. It brought to mind the words that we use often to ground ourselves at the beginning of service, acknowledging the lives that came before us, the people who loved and breathed us into being. Since the beginning of human history, people have lived and loved and lost. We have struggled and suffered and thrived and survived. And as each generation slips away to make room for the next, what continues on? It's love. Love is what connects us all to everyone, everywhere, backwards and forward through time. Love is at the center of our faith. Love abides. I have a brief PS. I never got the letter that I had hoped for from my dad, but a few years after he died, I got a song. If you recall, I mentioned earlier the lines that my dad had written in my birthday card, the odd misspelling that tipped us off to his illness. He had written, "I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know." Always know what? What was the rest of it? What was it from? I didn't recognize the words and was quickly distracted by the events that followed, and I never asked him. The card was put away, and that was that. Well, a number of years later, I was sitting at my desk at work listening to this cool new thing called Pandora, which was playing me a mix of songs that it thought I would like. And all of a sudden, I heard these familiar slash mysterious words coming through my headphones, sung by Paul Simon. There it was, a song written for the animated children's movie, The Wild Thornberries, and called, what else? Father and Daughter. The full chorus of the song was the message I needed. I'm gonna watch you shine, gonna watch you grow, gonna paint a sign so you'll always know, as long as one and one is two. There could never be a father who loved his daughter more than I love you. Love abides. May it be so.